It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
All right, we have started recording. Now I will sit back as I assume you're gonna sing.
No.
Okay. But it's my birthday.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Happy birthday.
I think it's the first time we ever recorded on my birthday. All right. Well, the listeners are going to have to handle it for you then, because you clearly don't love me enough. So the listeners do. So we're going to give some time here for the listeners to sing. I will set the rhythm and I will try and get a little background sort of just to keep you on track, guys. All right. All right. So me. All right. One. And then everybody clap.
Oh, it's like a church organ.
All right. So hopefully you guys sang along in that part. If you didn't, back it up, do it again. Sing. All right.
I feel bad because that's like, I was going to say happy birthday to you earlier today. And I thought that's dumb. I'm going to see him like tonight on his birthday. And then I forgot to say happy birthday.
Well,
I wasn't going to sing it anyway. So
despite that, I'm having a pretty awesome birthday.
Oh, that's good.
And a lot of it has nothing to do with my birthday. So, when we didn't do this at this time 4 years ago, but when the election was done in 2016 and Trump won, we usually don't do a lot of politics, but we kind of broke with that, and we got that whole episode was kind of us dealing with the trauma of having experienced that. So I'm going to break here again. So the inauguration was yesterday. I didn't watch it because I was super happy it was happening. I had no interest in bothering to see it. I saw a couple of news things about it, whatever. So today is when, you know, the real news kicks in about things starting and stuff like that. And due to birthday things and other stuff, I only just like an hour ago got to do my usual run through my websites to catch up on the day's news. And I'm trying to be balanced and objective in my sort of view of things. And I'm trying to remember that people sort of on the other side of this equation maybe felt this way in January of 2017. I don't know. And I'm trying not to jump to conclusions or get too excited or anything. It's just, it's beautiful. It's so, I could not have hoped for things to be like so quickly. Things that are wrong are being set right already. And things are in motion to set other parts right. Horrible people are losing their resources and their support. It's the exact opposite of all the fear and dread I had in the early days of a Trump presidency. It's so hopeful and it's so wonderful and I'm so happy about it. I mean, even down to things that I couldn't have predicted would happen, like QAnon. QAnon supporters are waking up. Like I expected, you know, that, like, oh, you know, it'd be sad and they're kind of a crazy minority, so they disappear. No, hundreds and thousands of QAnon supporters are like, we got scammed, didn't we? Like, this was all bullshit. I never could have predicted that that would happen. It's just wonderful. And so, and the few and holdouts from Trump appointees are being fired right away, and things are being, it's just so awesome, and I'm so happy. It's really made today great outside of all my birthday stuff. You have an oddly blank look on your face.
I hadn't heard anything about the QAnon thing you're talking about.
Yeah. All the QAnon forums are loaded with a bunch of people like saying, oh no, what's happening? And some of them are trying to be convinced that Biden is somehow involved in fighting the secret cabal of pedophiles and whatever. But a whole lot of QAnon supporters are just like, we got scammed. This is bullshit, people. And including one of the guys largely responsible for making it such a huge movement. He himself was like, we lost. We have to deal with it, that we have to respect the Constitution and the administration. And, you know, we're all friends and we had a great time, basically.
Huh. I hadn't heard any of that. That's good news. It's very good news. I hadn't heard any of that.
Tons of executive orders that are fixing a lot of things. We're no longer leaving the World Health Organization. We're rejoining the Paris Climate Accords. A whole bunch of stuff in place to deal with COVID in terms of both safety and vaccine rollout, like 10 separate executive orders related to that. Things that are strengthening protections for trans individuals that are really pissing off other people, which is awesome to me because I'm in favor of that. And I like when it pisses off people who aren't. Some of the holdout shitty people, Ted Cruz, Stephen Miller, are saying things on social media because they still have their accounts and just absolutely getting ratioed to all hell and just owned, like nobody's there to hear it right now. And one of my websites that I frequent, AV Club, which does pop culture news, has covering a lot of Trump for the last 5 years or so because he unfortunately was a part of it, has declared that now that he's out, they're just not covering anything he does anymore, no matter what it is. Just like, we're not going to talk about him anymore because we're tired of talking about him. I love that. Outside of potential schadenfreude with any trials he might be involved in, I'm at a point where I really can forget he exists. That I love that. I've been waiting for that for so long. Again, the look on your face, I'm getting a strong vibe of none of this is resonating with you in the same way.
I don't believe that's going to happen. I don't believe people will stop talking about him. I mean, I hope it happens.
I believe people will, but I don't need you.
No, I know.
Big sites,
Right. I'm just saying there's a lot of things I'm obviously more skeptical about. The thing about that I've liked, there are a lot of the things that the executive order things, there are some of them that I don't care one way or the other for. The ones that I am most interested in are about, you know, immigration and stuff. I'm very, very happy for that stuff to get, you know, fixed, especially, I mean, I don't usually like executive orders in principle. I mean, that's part of it. But you know, there were some executive orders in relation to immigration and things that were probably not constitutional to begin with, you know, so.
Yeah. He scrapped the Muslim ban, all that bullshit.
Yeah. All that stuff and helping, the Dreamers and all that. I mean, to me, I don't know if we've talked about immigration very much here, but to me, the way immigration is treated in this country, and sometimes by the Democrats too, is like, this is ridiculous. This isn't
absolutely,
this actually isn't that hard. And Trump went the exact wrong direction, as everybody knows, I think. And so I was very glad to see that get fixed. I don't think the Paris Accords are as big a deal as other people think it is, but I'm not opposed to it or anything. I just don't I mean, I just don't think that's, I think that tackling climate change, the Paris Accord is, I don't think is a big important part of that, in my opinion. But
I would, I'll put it this way. I agree. Being a part of the Paris Climate Accord is not at all a big deal in terms of the fight against climate change. Not being a part of the Paris Climate Accord, however, is a big deal in the wrong direction.
Well, I mean, it seems like...
Is it a symbolic thing? Yes, but if you decide to not be involved in the symbolic thing, that's huge.
Yeah, that exactly. I've always been sort of that opinion about it. Like, there were a lot of people that thought, like, that it was a big symbolic thing to get out of it. And I thought, oh, not really. It's like, this isn't, you're not achieving. I mean, it doesn't, whatever. My point is, I don't have a problem with the United States being part of it. I don't have a problem with us not being a part of it, but I mean,
that's where we differ.
Yeah. I don't,
'cause I didn't give a shit about the Paris Climate Accords until we left, because it is a huge message to the world to leave that. And it's a shitty message.
Sure.
I mean, part of it is a fairly milquetoast message, but choosing not to be.
Yeah.
It's being the one guy who doesn't want free bus fares for war widows. Like, well, bus fares for war widows is not a big deal. But if you're the one guy that says, fuck those war widows, that's a thing.
I don't know if it's quite like that. It is. It's certainly, you know, we're supposed to be an example for the world and whatever, and it doesn't really cost us anything to be part of it. So, I mean, it seemed like a dumb thing for Republicans, as usual, to turn into a thing. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we have to get out of this because what? I mean, like you say, it's mostly symbolic, but you know,
Ted Cruz said today, apparently we care more about citizens in Paris than we do about Americans. That's what the Paris Climate Accord is about. It's about Paris.
Yeah, that's a dumb thing to say. It's a battle that should, I mean, it's a hill that the Republicans should never have said, we're going to fight on this. It's dumb. But all of that said, you know, I look at a lot of the executive, like I said, I don't like executive orders in principle. I look at some of them and are like, yeah, whatever, I can take or leave. But some of them, they matter. And for me, particularly, it's the immigration ones that matter, because those were particularly egregious, in my opinion, when those were first put out.
I would agree. I also think the COVID ones are incredibly important.
Well, see, I don't know anything about those ones, I guess. I didn't really know there were a lot of...
There are 10 of them, and I don't know all of them. It was... Basically, what it turns out is that the previous administration had nothing. They hadn't invoked anything. And so he's done the Defense Production Act. He's invoked that so that they can
make... Oh, sure.
And he's put a couple of councils together to actually monitor the rate at which the vaccines are going out and dealing with who needs what in terms of materiel. What else was in there? I don't know. There was a bunch of stuff, not just about getting people vaccinated, but keeping people safe. There's things in there to create liability and punishments, for lack of a better word, for employers who willfully risk their employees in this time. He put together a group. I don't know. They compared it to something Roosevelt did during the New Deal. There's a particular board he has put together to oversee a bunch of this. It's great stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember what he did specifically reaffirmed trans rights, because I don't think it was a particularly big thing, but it really pissed off the trans exclusionist community around the world. And so I'm always like, that's gotta be awesome then.
Yeah. I don't think I'd heard of that one either. I've been very light on the news lately. There's been other things going on, so I've been missing some things.
Oh, I have just been super psyched. And as somebody pointed out, we all know the joke. Well, I assume we all know the joke of the episode of The Simpsons that's in the future, and Lisa Simpson becomes president, and she talks about what she's been left behind after President Trump. Which back then was a ridiculous joke, but then it happened. As somebody pointed out, the outfit that Lisa wears in the Oval Office looked like eerily similar to the outfit Kamala Harris wore at the inauguration. I saw side by side and I'm like, okay, that's a little freaky. So once again, the prophetic power of the Simpsons. It's also been a very good birthday in general. I got some cool presents, including this, which is a weird one, but it's awesome. These are LED strip light kits so that I can stick them on walls or backing behind things. And they do all sorts of different colors and changes and patterns and stuff like that. I'm going to mess with that. My big present, though, so far that I've really been excited about is I got 5 pouches of very fancy salt.
Oh.
Pink Himalayan salt, gray French salt, smoked sea salt, which apparently is really amazing, black lava salt, and another one I can't remember the name of. Apparently it's a sea salt that evaporates, comes from tidal pools that evaporate and then mixes with red volcanic clay. And I'm very excited about those. Also got a Black Lives Matter t-shirt from my mom. So that's a thing.
Okay. Yeah. That's cool.
And some really comfy slippers that I'm wearing. But yeah, it's been a very good birthday.
Good.
For those of you just joining us, every week on this podcast, we just celebrate my birthday. no. Oh, wait, sorry. I would say hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast in the world that celebrates my birthday. William's birthday is celebrated on this podcast and My Favorite Murder podcast. You Made It Weird with Pete Holmes. And Indoor Kids with Camille Nanjiani and Emily V. Gordon. A couple of others I can't remember, but there's a handful that celebrate William's birthday.
Everyone is celebrating my birthday this year because my birthday is on Mardi Gras.
Ooh.
No, it's all for me. It's all for me.
Yeah. My apologies. I'm pretty sure... I'm pretty sure a lot of shit is going to be done in the name of celebration that you wouldn't want associated with your birthday.
Probably. But
I do love that your birthday is there to ring in my favorite time of year, the year when all the fast food places come up with their seafood option.
Yeah, right.
Can you eat chicken on Fridays during Lent? Is chicken, like the no meat thing.
I don't know.
What applies as meat? Because everybody's focused on fish, but don't get me wrong, I'm super happy about it. But I'm like, what about just chicken?
Well, as a vegetarian, I can tell you that I was never asked, can you eat chicken? But I was often asked, well, can you eat fish? Like,
which has become a thing.
Yeah.
Which is why pescatarian is like a real term now.
But I mean, this is like, I've been a vegetarian for like 25 years or something, and I've always been asked that question. Oh, can you eat fish? But I've never been asked if I eat any other kind of meat, just fish.
Yep. So. Yep. Somebody actually, Coffee, a longtime listener, friend of the show, Coffee, explained her situation very clearly to me one time when I was asking about that. She says, don't eat anything with a nervous system. And I was like, all right, that actually is pretty clear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know people who don't eat red meat specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have different definitions of red meat.
Yeah.
So right. Then that gets tricky. So it's sort of all over the place. Yeah, the fish one, it's weird. As an omnivore, I'm fine with whatever voluntarily imposed dietary restrictions anyone has, because how would I get mad at somebody for just eating less things than I do? or fewer things than I do. I've never known what the argument is for pescatarians.
I don't know. I know why someone would eat fish, you know, for dietary reasons.
Sorry. I have never, ethical pescatarians, I have never known the argument.
Yeah, for. but why?
They exist, yeah. I mean,
why, again, fish is very good for you, and there are some people that, I have to take supplements as a vegetarian. I was a pescatarian, I wouldn't have to do that. So, you know, but
or of if course, you ate more of certain kinds of algae.
Sure. But for me personally, if I decided, gosh, you know, for my dietary needs, I should start eating fish, I would probably just start eating, you know, beef or whatever else.
And as we've established, your dietary restrictions are not ethical based.
That's true. Not, they're not really.
That I don't care about why people have dietary restrictions for their health or whatever. Like, I'm happy that they know that and can do something about that. But I'm like, that's not oh, why is it like that? Because I don't, you know.
I mean, do you think?
But I believe there are a lot of people who ethically are like, I don't eat meat, but I do eat fish. And I think they have an argument for it. And I don't know. I've yet to hear what it is. I haven't ever asked a pescatarian.
No, I never have either. I don't know.
I think there, I mean, in my head, there's an argument of, you know, sort of lower life forms and consciousness and receptor pain and stuff like that, which I can get. If you think certain animals are less capable of suffering, then I get it. Or even if it's to the degree of how it's treated as a food product and how ethical their treatment is, I understand the concept. I could see somebody making that argument for fish and seafood. I'm not sure that argument holds if that is somebody's argument. Again, this is a complete straw man on my part.
But it could be also just cultural, right? I mean, it's a strong thing in our culture for fish to be excluded from the category of meat, you know, so maybe it's just in people's heads that it's not the same thing. I mean, it's just this
cultural. And that's my hunch is that's where some of that is.
I see.
But I would hope people who for ethical reasons actively restrict their diet would have given it more thought than just accepting a sort of cultural artifact. If you're a pescatarian, please tell us. Or if you know one that has explained it to you, at the blog, magicaltalkinghat.com, and tell us what are pescatarians thinking. Again, no judgment. I'm just curious as the argument. It's a purely academic question. Anyway, I'm Tony. Did I say that? No, I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 514.
Now, for those of you just joining us, here's how the show is. We have a hat. It is magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And people, good people, kind people, wonderful people, intelligent people, sexy people, write into that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with a little note. Little comments, little topics, little questions, things like that. The hat, magically, all on its own, transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. We, birthday boy, servants, draw note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, about them till we're bored. Do that for about an hour. That's the whole show, except the parts that aren't, which is most of it. So, how's your week been?
I mean, there's a lot of things going on, but I the only thing I really feel like talking about is the game. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you and I have talked some, and I figured,
yeah,
there are things you wouldn't want to talk about because you're not a freak desperate for attention like I am.
I mean, I don't want anyone, like, there's nothing to worry about. Everything's fine. I just, you know, things have
terrible
been going
tragedies
on.
Tragedies on Oak Island.
I just want to talk about something else. So we're playing the game still. Oh, it's the system's called Cortex Prime, I want to say.
Yeah. Okay. I have a couple of games from that. That is a company, I want to say author Margaret Weiss started it. And it was very interesting because it got a lot of IP right off the bat. I have a Firefly game that is based off the Cortex system. And they got a lot of, like, CW, there's like a Buffy game and an Angel game and a Leverage game and things. And these were all based off of the Cortex system, which looked at the time to me very much just sort of like a modified version of a D20 system. But yeah, Dave has suddenly gotten into it, and I trust Dave's views on systems, so I'm curious.
Well, you know, my experience with these games, and this is going to sound perfectly pedestrian to you guys who've been doing this for a long time, is it's just like anything else. it's just like anything else. For it to work for a given player, for whatever their style of player personality, whatever it is, it's gotta be a good balance of freedom and constraint, right? I mean, if you have too much freedom, I mean, that can be a good thing, but then, you know, it can make the gameplay too hard because you're almost having to make every decision from scratch, right? It's like every time you're giving a decision, you're practically world building before each decision as the player. It's like, wait.
A lot of the load comes on the players and also to the GM potentially in those situations.
Right. But if there are too many constraints, then you're not really making decisions at all.
You're just playing a video game with really low tech.
That's right. So I think a game that really hit a good balance for me personally was Fate, which is why when I came up with that gingerbread game or whatever, I just kind of built it around Fate or whatever. I like this game though, because the way they set up your dice pool and all that stuff, it doesn't feel like you're just going through a mechanic or the technical aspects of it. It feels like you're making actual decisions about your character and even your character arc. And, you know, it really does help you think through the whole thing as far as I'm concerned. I heard another player express a different sentiment. Like this player didn't feel like they were getting a sense of his character or the place. But I had the exact opposite experience with it. I mean, just going through the work of figuring out, you know, what the dice assignments were going to be and stuff, it just really facilitated for me personally that fleshing all of that stuff out, which made the actual playing easier. And then when you do play, now with Dave, it might be different than other GMs, but of course, you know, once you've got your dice set up and everything, and that's sort of kind of guided you in creating the world you're in and the player you are, you won't necessarily be rolling dice all the time. You know, it's not a grind with the dice. Now, again, yeah. Dave, that's kind of the kind of GM he is. Maybe another GM would do it different.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's been really, I've really liked it. Now, the thing I want to talk about though is this. So I'm playing a smuggler, right?
I thought you were playing a dishwasher.
Anyway.
I love that idea that actually your public face is that of a smuggler, but secretly you're also a dishwasher.
That's right. But this time around, there were a couple things. I got a little bit of feedback from the players. One was that that my character was so nice. They didn't say too nice, but they kept talking about how nice he was.
Mm-hmm.
And two, that he was too risk averse. were not too risk averse, but they, you know, I think they did think he was too risk averse. Now, the nice thing, actually, I didn't understand either of these things because my character is nice, but he's nice to like his customers, right? I mean, he's being nice to people. He's a business person. He's trying to do good business. So, I mean, why would he not be nice to the people who he's in business with? Am I doing it wrong or something?
Now, off the top of my head, all I can think of is for the general archetype you have built, the other players may have an image based on popular media. And the image you have created is based on what you consider to be a rational way this character would work, and the two may not relate.
Okay, well, and this gets to the whole being risk averse thing, because one character sort of thought it was ironic when my character started being concerned about the risks of something. And Mark, I said something about, well, I think smugglers who want to stay smugglers would be risk averse. And Mark said something, he quoted Han Solo saying, never tell me the odds. And when I thought about this later, I thought, yeah, if I'm going to play a smuggler in an RPG, I am definitely not going to model it off of Han Solo, the worst smuggler ever. I mean, come on.
No, I think this is what we're getting to here. I think we'll just say smuggler. Like, your character is more nuanced than that. Well, if we're giving it a class or an archetype, you're playing a smuggler. And most players are going to both assume and personally want to play what they think is fun, which is a smuggler you'd see in a TV show or a movie. Usually an action sort of thing. Whereas what you're playing is how a smuggler should probably be if they want to be a successful smuggler.
Well, and he might be more of a trafficker than a smuggler. I mean, and he's kind of the boss. He's not like flying a ship around or anything. But that was established from the beginning that he's got a day job. And I not only did I establish he has a day job, but that he likes it. I mean, he likes being a dishwasher. So
this is a constant question in role-playing games of, do you do it realistic or do you do it fun? And not only is that a tricky balance for everyone, but also people's definition of fun varies.
Oh yeah. I love it. I think it's totally fun.
People's definition of realistic also varies.
Yeah. I think it's totally fun to play them like this. I've been having a ball, but maybe they
if you're having a ball, they are fine with how you're playing it, like in terms of as far as their gameplay experience, it's great. If they think it's weird, I would take that as a compliment.
I think they're amused by it, which is great.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But this got me thinking about something else, and then I can stop talking about this.
We'll see.
So, you know, of course, there are tropes in RPGs like in everything else. And to me, in role-playing games, tropes are particularly used. I mean, like you don't really avoid them. You use them to sort of shortcut get into the character, into the whatever. But hopefully, you know, like anything else, where you kind of have to, out of convenience and efficiency, rely on tropes at first. Hopefully you're not, you know, staying stuck to that. But then it made me think,
unless that's what the group wants, but yeah.
Well, okay, so that's what I was thinking about, was I started to think that maybe sometimes tropes are used in RPGs to signal to other players, hey, I know what my lane is and I'm going to stay in it, and you don't have to feel threatened by me, you know, my character going in some direction that's going to get in your way. Do you think that's ever true? Do you think tropes are ever used as a way to sort of normalize play and you know, make it so?
Yeah,
that
absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why, and you've never played in games like this back in the day, and it's still true in some games today, you have character classes. do that exact thing. If you're playing D&D, well, heck, they've started borrowing from MMOs in this. You need a tank, you need some strikers, you need a controller, you need a healer. This has always been the thing. You're building a D&D group, you need some sort of fighter who's going to be out in front and take the hits and all that. You need somebody who's at least one person who's good at magic, and you need at least one person who's going to heal you. And so it usually is a fighter, a priest, and a cleric. And then if you've got enough people, you can also have a thief who will be really useful. These were the building blocks of a standard adventuring party. And that's still a thing. And we talk about it now, even when we're building, even when you don't have classes in certain games, it's like, okay, who's going to be the tech person in this one? Okay, who's going to be the combat person? Who's the face? That's the constant one, mostly in my group, because nobody actually thinks they're any good at it. But who is the social person who will get you through those scenarios when the rest of you are like, like the person who will convince someone to give them the information, the person who can make their way through the party without getting noticed, you know, at the big gala event and things like that. Who's going to play the face? That's a very common question, and it still exists today. And it's more and more and more and more, I look at role-playing games the same way I look at basic cable genre fiction. All of your one-hour TV shows that are sci-fi, that are fantasy, that are horror, that are, you know, heist related, that are action shows for whatever. Those are all very mediocre television. They're all really good role-playing campaigns. Like the way things work and the level of detail and the level of melodrama and the just enough making sense so you can move on. If you stop and look at it, it doesn't make sense. That's how role-playing games are. And there's a lot of shit that you're like, in retrospect, it didn't work. But at the moment, it was good. And we went through it and it was awesome. We had a great time. More and more, I look at them that way. And vice versa, I look at role-playing games that way too. What's going to be fun?
Well, I think when I feel insecure about, you know, whatever I'm doing, which is all the time, I think one of the big concerns I have specifically is, you know, what, and I didn't really know how to conceptualize this until recently, is whether or not other players are going to feel like I popped out of my lane, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, here I am, I'm a criminal in this game. I mean, that's, you know, that's my highest stat is a criminal stat. You know, smuggler is the term that I used at the beginning, which maybe that's not the best term or whatever, but I'm not, if I notice people are observing that I'm doing it in a way that's different than they expect, and they're not saying it mean or anything, like I think they're amused by it, right? But it makes me nervous because it's like, okay, you're amused by it now. How far can I take this before you're not, now this isn't funny anymore, William. You're not staying in your lane. This is, you've got it. I know what to do with my lane because all you other people aren't getting into my lane. You know what I mean? And so I don't.
That only matters in two circumstances. One is, are there things that the party needs you to be doing in order for them to be successful within the game and as a fun thing to do that you're not doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or are you doing things that really other people feel like it should be them who are doing those things and you're taking that away from them?
Yeah. Both of those things I worry about.
Are the two things to always worry about on a certain level. I would say from what you have described, I don't think it's a thing. There are people in this who know you. There are people in this who don't know you, but there are people in this who know you. And if you really are worried, ask.
Yeah, yeah.
At the beginning of a session, say, you know what? I'm not at all sure this is a thing. This is probably my own paranoia, but I just want to check that I'm not messing up other people's things. And there is a possibility that there are people in that group who don't know you very well, who do have things, but wouldn't be comfortable just telling you. Mm-hmm. But very seldom, if you're screwing up as a player in a role-playing game, is it bugging just one person?
Yeah.
If that's the case, it's often more the issue of that one person. And there are enough people in that who know you, who know they could tell you, and who will probably tell you, no, it's great. Keep in mind, those are the only two things. So playing the character in a way nobody else would expect, playing the character in a way that they wouldn't play it, playing the character as a jerk or as a particularly nice guy when they were expecting, like, none of that matters in terms of making it okay for everyone else. It's are you not doing things that they kind of need you to for the game to work for them?
Yeah.
Or are you doing things that are getting in the way of it? Which I say that other people could be doing. Time also counts. What you're doing is spending 85% of the session using it for your character. Whereas that is staying outside of your lane in just a very basic sense. But it all boils down to those two things. And it sounds like you're not doing those things.
Well, I hope not. I mean,
I ask.
Yeah. There was a moment in the game where I hadn't been doing very much. And I think I've already said this. I feel like it suits my character just fine to sort of be on the fringes. And like, I even said afterwards, a lot of times my character, Bill, gets to, like, I haven't done very much during the game, yeah. but at the end, everybody gets to say a little thing about what they're doing right at the end.
Yeah.
And I can eat very quickly, build a scene that was almost a little cliffhangery for him, that, you know, a little zinger at the end. It's like, I like that. That's perfect. That works for my character. That works for me. And so I wasn't doing a lot this game either. And then suddenly this big action scene happened that I didn't have anything to do with. And it was really cool and all this stuff. And then while this was going on, I was in a particular location with another character who also wasn't doing anything. And so it came up and said, well, do your scene together now.
Okay.
And I was totally confused because like, all of this stuff happened and I didn't know if I was supposed to, like, are we going back in time and showing what the scene, you know, was when it started? Or is it happening while the fight's going on? Or is this after the fight? I was completely...
Which are absolutely legitimate questions for your GM. And hopefully he will answer them.
Oh, he did. It was difficult because, I mean, when you're playing it online, it's not Zoom, but it's a little like that. It can get really confusing what people are asking because then you can't hear people and stuff. So there's a little bit of confusion there, but it's like, I thought, well, I don't
know. And that's wholly on GM, who I'm assuming, you need to say, all right, while that's happening, that's usually how I say it. While that's happening, what are you guys doing?
Well, the thing is, he might have said that and I just didn't hear him. So I was like, what's going on?
Let me ask you this. Do you find that characters or players ask that your character do things a lot, like sort of prompt you to do stuff?
Okay, well, no. I mean, there have been a couple times where the GM has, sort of.
Yeah, a couple times is not a lot.
But the reason I bring that up is because I think... in, like, if there have been three times, two of those three times, you know, one time I was passing another character and the question was, so what's Bill saying to Vox, this other character?
Yeah.
I mean,
but that's fine. That's not the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like, you think you might want to go unlock that door you just want to go, you know?
No.
How about really. You help us by buying the whatever, you know, that kind of thing?
No, not really.
Mm-mm. And I think that first issue we talked about, not doing things that they need you to do, isn't happening. Mm. because that's a sign that it's not, that's a sign that it's happening. People will try and nudge you to do those things.
Oh.
Either in character or out of character. And frequently it's not that subtle in my experience. It'll be like, well, since William's playing the smuggler character, I just assumed he'll do XYZ.
This is probably, I mean, while it's happening, I don't think about it that much. This is all stuff I think about later where it's like, oh, wait, was that right? Should I have done?
I'm at the point where I would put sizable amounts of money on you're doing fine.
I hope
nobody's having a problem with it.
I feel fine at the time.
I think asking is good. Yeah, no, but I think the odds are incredibly high. This is all in your head.
Well, one of the reasons I bring it up to talk about it is, first of all, I'm interested in your opinion, but also maybe some of, and I know there's other people, there are people who listen who play RPGs, and maybe it would interest them to hear a new player talking about some of their issues and struggles.
So, Dave, you're listening to this podcast. You are the GM. You are a very experienced and good GM. You know if the group is having issues with William or whatever. Tell him it's fine. Contact him individually. Or if there is an issue, tell him about that and give him some suggestions.
Yeah. I'm
like, David knows the answer to this.
And Dave's doing
based on who he is and no, but I mean the things you're questioning.
Yeah.
I promise you he knows. Because A, he's the GM, which gives him a big advantage in that direction. But B, he's Dave.
Sure.
He's observant. He's experienced. So he'll be able to tell you if there is a thing like that.
Yeah,
so
I know.
Tell him.
But I'm not talking about this to air a grievance. I'm just talking about this to get your input on
it. Yeah. But you're also expressing questions and concerns that there may be issues.
That are all
and you are experiencing anxiety from that. And I'm saying, Dave, can either put your anxieties at rest, or if there really is something to work on, he can help tell you what that is. And either way, that's useful.
But I suspect he would. In fact, one of the big pieces of evidence that everything's fine is that he's not. So I should not worry about it. I mean, I'm doing this to myself.
I think you are correct in that.
Yeah.
I also think it doesn't exactly cost Dave anything to send an email and be like, no, dude, you're doing fine. Dave, save me from more of this bullshit.
Come on. Do you really not want me to talk about
it? No. I find it fascinating. No.
Okay.
I love you talking about the game. I don't like that most of your talk about the game is, I think I might be bad at it.
Like, shut up.
That is your insecurities about your role playing are the least interesting part. Your feelings about playing games and your experience with a given character and stuff, that stuff I love. And weird things you come across, like when you come across a role playing crossroads of some sort. Like before, when you talked about like situations where you meant to say things certain way, but because you're you, it comes out different, or like you're having trouble being a criminal. These things I find fascinating. Whether or not you might suck at it, less so.
I know, it's just a thing.
I understand, and I feel the same thing. It's not as interesting to hear about, but it's real. I experience them all the time. I've been doing this for decades. I still experience it as a player or as a GM. It's just there.
Yeah. Well, I'm also trying to figure out.
Interesting thing for you to talk about.
I'm also trying to figure out the cultural elements. That's why I brought up the whole trope thing as the trope as norm, right? Like it's not just an easy thing you use to get started. It's a thing you use to signal to other players that you respect their lane.
Yes.
Right.
And it's a thing because you want to have that adventure. You don't want to have necessarily a realistic smuggling run. I mean, again, to use that, which I understand that's not what you do, but like a realistic smuggling trip. No, you want a smuggling trip that looks like that scene in that movie. You want to be the characters in that movie. You want it to be your own thing, but like you want that. So, I mean, there's so much stuff like I said, built into the game I'm doing now, they build it in. They're like, here's this weird thing about the world we invented, and here's our stupid rationale for it. And the real reason is, if you did it realistically, it would be boring and tedious to play.
Yeah.
So, well, like, they have dumb shit. In my game, most stuff happens with non-lethal damage, because you're essentially law enforcement, and so you don't normally just kill people. And because of that, the way non-lethal damage works, you basically have phasers set to stun. The first time you get hit with it, it doesn't knock you out. It makes you easier to hit and sort of throws things off, but it takes two hits to actually knock you out. And that's because if everything could be taken care of with one hit in action sequences and fight scenes, that would get really boring. Like, there would be very little action in that situation. It's the same way that in a lot of these, they have hit points or some sort of damage abstraction, because the real answer is, if I shoot you in the head with a bullet, you're dead. We're done. That's not a fun fight scene. in the same way that people in movies get shot like five times and still be going, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, this game, I really like it a lot. I like the setup. I like everything about it. And also, you know, Dave said at the beginning that, you know, we laugh and have a good time and everything, but he wanted it to be kind of, you know, for playtesting purposes, kind of serious and dramatic or whatever.
Yeah.
That's another thing that sort of informed the creation of my character, because I thought it would be interesting. I mean, not just to be a type of whatever, but to be a criminal, but a business, you know, someone who cares about it's a business. And to get the criminal part of the way I said it during the session was that it's a business. It's, you know, this is good business for Bill to do this way. But if you cross him, you're going to see a completely different thing, you know, because
it's still just business.
Yeah, exactly. Because here's the thing about Bill that I realized. He is generous. He's sincere. Like, if he's thanking you for something, it's because he's really grateful. He's also getting something out of it, but he is truly grateful. If he's sorry, he's truly regretful. He is a nice guy. Truly, he is. But he's not a good guy.
Yep.
And if, you know, if you put yourself in a particular orientation toward him, you'll find that out. And to me, that's interesting.
I love that. I think that's a great idea.
I think that's really interesting.
We talk about these tropes and these classes and things, and a lot of people have been playing for a long time, and they're like, we got to mix it up. And so a lot of us will say, like, I'm playing this kind of character, but unlike most of them, they're kind of like this or whatever. You know, they have a twist on it or whatever. And that's a lot of us do that kind of thing. But the other thing I will say is, one of the greatest dynamic narrative arc kind of campaigns I ever played was an Earthdawn campaign. And I started out playing intentionally the most generic, cliche fantasy thief character you've ever seen in your life. And he went on such an arc and changed over time into the most like odd, like nuanced character, unusual character, who eventually literally killed himself to save all of his companions at the end. And he started off as the most selfish character, but like, so that can also be fun too, is to start off with a trope and then see where it grows from there.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I think what you're doing makes a lot of sense and sounds really cool.
Well, anyway, how was your week? You probably have a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Bad news. We're not going to get to no question today, because I do have a lot I want to talk about. And also, I'm not going to run long. I haven't had supper yet. Tonight's going to be sushi. So.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, y'all, but it's my birthday. So fuck y'all.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
I have a lot to talk about from this week, other than the things I've already talked about from this week. I have another movie recommendation for everyone. As you may recall, was it last week I recommended Ma Rainey's Black Bottom on Netflix? Still recommend that. Amazing film. Absolutely. Everyone should watch it. Watch it now. It's great. I have another one for you. This one is on Amazon Prime. It is called One Night in Miami. And it has recently come out on Amazon Prime. It is notable, among other things, for being the directorial debut of Regina King. Who you might know as the main character from Watchmen.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
From tons of other things, too. She's quite a prolific and successful actress.
Yes, yes.
That's where most recently. This is her directorial debut. Okay. What this is... This is another piece of historical fiction. So here's the history for you. One night in Miami, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, still being known as Cassius Clay, NFL superstar Jim Brown, and hugely popular singer Sam Cooke all got together in a hotel room and hung out. The very next day, Cassius Clay announced that he was a Muslim and very soon afterwards changed his name. Within a year, Malcolm X was assassinated. Shortly after, Sam Cooke wrote some of his more political songs that mattered. You know, before then, it was very poppy sort of stuff. And Jim Brown quit the NFL and acting full time. Throughout their lives, so long as they lasted, they all spoke of that evening as being a major turning point for a lot of them and a very influential evening. They did not speak anything of the specifics of what happened that night. And this movie, again, based off of a play like with Ma Rainey, is a theoretical version of what happened that night. It is, again, impeccably performed. Everyone nails their character, which in the case of Cassius Clay and Malcolm X characters is admirable. In the case of the Sam Cooke character, it's fascinating to me because it's Leslie Odom Jr., who you can, it's so him, but he also just really nails Sam Cooke. And then Jim Brown is played by a hugely jacked Aldis Hodge, who is an up-and-coming character actor who I always know as the hacker from Leverage. But he's really been getting some major character roles, and it was really impressive. Like, he nails the tone of voice, and this, and it's a great movie. Mm-hmm. And again, as with Ma Rainey, yes, it's an important movie, and yes, it deals with some very serious shit. It is not a difficult movie to watch or a torturous movie. It is very entertaining. It is also very significant. And also just brilliant in terms of stagecraft and things. So I recommend both of them as strongly as I can to everyone. They're really good.
Cool.
So go watch it right now. I'll wait. Also, I have a disc recommendation.
Okay.
Also on Netflix. George Clooney directed, although I think he may have directed things before. I'm not sure this is his debut. Midnight Sky.
We did see that, yeah.
How did you like it?
Didn't like it.
Trish brought up some very strong arguments against it that were completely unrelated to my feelings on it. Reasons why it was really kind of shit. I think there's a lot you can argue about the quality of the film, narratively and in film craft and stuff like that. And I have discussed it already. Beyond any of that, could be the best made film ever. And I still wouldn't recommend it because it is 100% made up bummer. It is a completely fictional story that is just sad. It could best be summarized as like shitty things happen to a lot of people and we feel bad about it. The end. Like, it's just a bummer. And I don't get anything out of it. And there's a lot of other things to nitpick, but it mostly is just like, it's just a downer of a film, and there's nothing other than an incredibly vague and poorly defined standard climate change is going to kill us all and we should be aware of it message. It's just a bummer.
So I mean, I didn't care about that. I just didn't think the story was very well told.
No, there were some definite issues with the story, but I also don't think it was a story worth telling.
Possibly.
That's my big thing. Is I'm like, there were some definite issues with how the story had been told. And Trish had some issues with the messaging within the story that I think quite valid as well. And kind of some sexist bullshit in there. And just as a little cherry on the top of this disrecommendation Sunday, it had the problem that's happening more and more as I get older. George Clooney's is the main character. We have flashbacks to when he was younger, and he doesn't look a fucking thing like Booker from Roseanne. You know what George Clooney looked like when he was the age of this flashback character, and he didn't look anything like that. And that is happening as actors are aging in things. When they do flashbacks and they've cast someone else, and I'm like, you don't look like a young that person, because I saw movies with a young that person in it, and that's not what they look like. You know, it's unavoidable. It always still just bugs the shit out of me. In the realm of video games, earlier today, I finished, I beat the Final Fantasy VII remake.
Mm.
And it has left me with things to say about this. And I don't know how much it is important to say, you and a fair number of our listeners at least have no experience with this game, with the original game.
No.
So rather than not talk about it, though, I'm just going to talk about it in a much more drawn out fashion.
Okay.
So back in the day, in the 1980s, I think, there's a little video game company in Japan called Squaresoft.
Yep, Squaresoft.
And they are not doing well. Their business is, it was the 80s, it was video game companies. Like, nobody knew. It was like, it's the equivalent of in the aughts when online companies happened and it was a huge boom and then it sort of blew up. So this company doesn't know what the hell they're doing. So they're making one last game and they call it Final Fantasy. And it's an in-joke because the basics were, if this fails, we're done. Like, this is literally the last game we're going to make. But as luck would have it, it did not fail. It was quite successful. It was successful enough that it came to the US, which wasn't that big into role-playing games at that point in their video game. It came here and it was kind of successful too. Very successful in Japan, and they kept making more of them in Japan, which is why it got funny, because it's Final Fantasy 2, Final Fantasy 3, Final Fantasy 4, things like that. There was some modest success in the US, not a ton, as evidenced by the fact that in the US, Final Fantasy 2 was actually the fourth game in the series, and Final Fantasy 3 was actually, I think, the sixth game in the series. So they weren't that big here, but some of them made it over here, and they were huge in Japan, and they're all different. They all set in different places and have different characters. There are certain things that are similar through them, but they're all different. And then Final Fantasy VII happened, and Final Fantasy VII was the most expensive video game to make ever at the time. And it was a huge leap in technology, and it had an enormous sprawling epic story involving environmentalism and romance and issues of self-identity and PTSD and things like that built into it. And it was a fantasy thing, but it also had a lot of sort of sci-fi elements to it. And it was wildly popular. It was something unlike anything anyone had ever seen. It is largely credited with the reason RPGs as a video game concept came a big deal in places other than Japan, and particularly in the US. It made all of the money. It spawned all of the ripoffs. It was enormous. It was huge, incredible. It later had a sequel movie. It had a lot of spin-off games. Its soundtrack won many, many awards. It was a huge thing. It started the company off on a whole new thing where Final Fantasy games are now huge worldwide events. Everybody's obsessed with them. And it largely did that for me as well, even though I had mixed feelings about the game. It opened a lot of things for me. So recently, they decided to do a remake. And they're not even messing around. It's just called Final Fantasy VII Remake. And they plan it as a series. So this first game, as I think I've mentioned before, just takes place in sort of the beginning of the original story. And stretched it out so that what was a few hours in the original game is now like a full-size game. And it's modernized in a lot of ways. Like, you know, there's voice acting, there's full motion video, there's, you know, it looks prettier. It's got more detail. The story is in more detail and things like that. And as I believe I had expressed before, some issues with this in that they hold on to a lot of things that made sense in the 80s and are kind of annoying now. And a lot of things that you could kind of gloss over in the story originally, because it was just little words that were on the screen for 2 seconds and a little sprite jumped up and down and left, now are more disconcerting. There's some racial stereotypes in the game I don't like. There's some really, the villains are way creepier in certain ways and stuff like that. So I had a hard time with it, and I still finished it, though. And in fact, a lot of what this game did is remind me of the things I liked about the original. I went and bought the original game. It was on sale right now for $8 for the PS4. May play that later. Speaking of this, because I now have a better sense of recommendations, things like that. This game is not for someone who didn't know the original and play it and like it. That probably sets a lot of you off. If you are in that camp, this game is for people who really liked the story and the characters, which I have to be honest, was not me for the most part. I was way more into the mechanics and all of the stuff. But it did something very interesting and cool, I think. They pulled a J.J. Abrams Star Trek. As you may recall, in the reboot of Star Trek, it's a little bit reboot and a little bit remake, but also kind of sequel, because they did something that basically made it into an alternate timeline from the original story. And that sort of explains why things are different in a certain way. I don't want to give spoilers or anything, and it's not time travel based, but this, I'd heard from people like they changed some things and stuff. It really is incorporated into the story that basically this is a retelling of what happened in Final Fantasy VII, but things are different, and things, we've come up with reasons why things will continue to be different. And it very much makes me think of that sort of Star Trek reboot and a little bit of the Star Galactica reboot of the, you know, all this has happened before and will happen again thing. And I, as a narrative concept, I really like that. And I wish more, I wish they keep remaking and rebooting stuff. I wish they would all do them this way. Like, buy it into the original. It also then gives you carte blanche to change what you want. You'll be like, yeah, because it's, you know, it's a different timeline, or it's a different reality, or we've, you know.
Right.
Things like that. And so it is kind of cool for that. And again, I don't think it's a particularly good game. That being said, I played it all the way to the end. And when they make the next game, I'll probably play it. I don't understand that, but there it is. And the more I think about it, the more this is not interesting to you or most of the listeners.
I just wanted
to talk about it.
Wasn't the first film with fully computer rendered human characters the Final Fantasy film?
Yes. It was called Final Fantasy: The Spirits Within.
Yeah.
And it as with all the other Final Fantasy things, was a completely unrelated story to any other Final Fantasy stuff. Although that one didn't even have like the similar things. There is a list of very specific things you can go through and say it first showed up in this Final Fantasy game and then in everyone afterwards. Certain types of animals, certain types of items, certain types of mechanics, certain types of mythological aspects. And Final Fantasy Spirits Within had almost none of that. That being said, it really ripped off its ending from Final Fantasy VII. As I was walking out of the theater, I heard some guy further back say, "Wow, if I had never played Final Fantasy VII, I'd really find the end of that movie confusing."
How many Final Fantasies have there been?
Well, in terms of the regular number, 15 so far. But it's not that easy an answer. There was Final Fantasy I. There was Final Fantasy II. There was Final Fantasy III. There was Final Fantasy IV. There was Final Fantasy V. There was Final Fantasy VI. Those were all just single games called Final Fantasy number. Then there was Final Fantasy VII. Then there were multiple spin-offs from Final Fantasy VII, like that were sequel stories that went on with specific characters and stuff like that. And there was a movie. Then there was Final Fantasy VIII, which admittedly by itself. Then there was Final Fantasy IX, which was interesting because it was the one where people had been complaining Final Fantasy was very little fantasy anymore, so they went back to sort of their old roots there. Then there was Final Fantasy X. Then Final Fantasy X got a sequel called Final Fantasy X-2. And then there was Final Fantasy XI, which was an MMO. And then there was Final Fantasy XII. And that also had one or two sort of spin-off games. And then there was Final Fantasy XIII, which had two sequels. And that one is interesting because Final Fantasy XIII is a fairly shitty game. Final Fantasy XIII-2 is a really good game, but it largely won't matter much if you didn't play Final Fantasy XIII, the first one. And then they made Final Fantasy XIV, which is also an MMO. And then they made Final Fantasy XV, which was originally going to be a Final Fantasy XIII thing. It was going to be in that family, but then they redid it and eventually repackaged it as Final Fantasy XV. And that has had a couple of spinoffs and a movie and a mobile game, I believe. And none of this includes a game they made called Final Fantasy Tactics, which, unlike most games, is set in the same world that they later set Final Fantasy XII in, and Final Fantasy Tactics Advanced, which was a variant, but also set in that world of Final Fantasy Tactics. None of this includes a lot of remasters where they like improved the cutscenes and stuff like that, or re-releases, or releases in groups and stuff like that. And little spin-off games like little chocobo games and stuff like that, little kids games and puzzle games and stuff like that. So it's a complicated question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot. Certain characters and and of course Kingdom Hearts. The Kingdom Hearts series was essentially a blending of Disney properties and Final Fantasy stuff.
Hmm.
And so a bunch of Final Fantasy characters show up in Kingdom Hearts. Yeah, it's a whole deal. And I used to be really beholden to it. And now I'm like, if it looks good, I play it. If not, I don't. Because it is great. And it was groundbreaking in so many ways, especially 7. The whole series was very groundbreaking and did some amazing stuff. It continues to do some amazing stuff, but it also feels like the past in a lot of ways. Only recently did it stop being turn-based combat. Only around Final Fantasy XII did it stop being turn-based combat, and that made a huge difference, because before then, even the really fancy-looking ones were still your people all sit on one side and kind of move like this back and forth for some reason until it's their turn, and then they do their one thing. And that can get old.
I don't like turn-based combat.
It's a very, very old school thing, and it's weird that it still exists sometimes now. But
well, it's especially bad when you're the person who's just watching the game. That's not fun at all. Watching turn-based combat is not fun.
When you're grinding, which still is a thing that exists, you're like, I'm not strong enough to go to the next part. I never beat, like, the game, the number of games I've played in the series and the number of games I beat in the series are not the same. And I have never beaten the original one. And part of it is I had it back on the old Nintendo Entertainment System. And I got to the thing where I had to go to the last dungeon. And I read up on it and stuff. And I was like, I am nowhere near ready. I would have to gain like 20 more levels. And I was like, that sounds boring as shit. Just wander randomly around the map until I get into a fight scene where all of my people are sitting here and all of their people are sitting here. And we're like, okay, my turn. Okay, turn. And then wait for them and do that for hours. And I was like, no.
See, I've never understood the turn-based thing. I mean, like when I'm watching an RPG video game, I think to myself, whoever sat down to make an RPG video game, like, oh, we want to have all these elements that RPGs have. I would think the one thing they wouldn't want to have is basically, let's have this part where people are rolling their dice and whatever. It's like, no. You don't want, keep that part out of it. Let's see the combat. That's what people want. They don't want to feel like they're actually playing a tabletop RPG, because if that's what they wanted, they just go play one.
Except, here's the thing. Because RPGs weren't, in comparison with tabletop RPGs, in fact, I wish they'd never been called RPGs as video games. It's a terribly poor name for it.
Yeah, you're right.
But no, what it came down to, as the person who played those games, I'll tell you what it is. The other ones, the real-time combat games, or the real-time, you know, thing, I was bad at those and intimidated by those. I didn't like things where I had to do split second timing or I would fuck it up. I didn't like the challenge. I didn't want difficulty in my game. And back in those days, they didn't know how to do that. Nowadays, they'll make a game and it has action and it has combat and it has difficulty levels.
Yeah.
And the people, normal might be hard, but there's always a super fucking easy if you just want to go through the motions and feel kind of badass difficulty. And that's what I play on. Final Fantasy Remake is it's managed to be like the original type of combat while being a real-time thing. It's kind of cool. Also, it had difficulty levels, and I set it to the lowest difficulty level right out the gate. Back in the day, they didn't really know how to do that yet, or it hadn't occurred to them, sort of. Be like, oh, no, make it action-y, easy, if they want. So this was the version of that. And there's still a challenge in that you have to grind sometimes. If you really want to get through this without having to be really clever or really, you know, utilize your things right and resource management and all that, you just wait till you're high enough level. And a lot of us did that. And that means a lot of video games that I loved and put literally hundreds of hours into, I have tried to go back and play and can't do because it's too tedious and boring for me now. Which may be what happens if I try and play the original Final Fantasy VII again. We will see.
Yeah.
It had a really cool skill and magic system that was very unique and still is fairly unique. That's the thing I like the best, and that's kind of why I want to go back and play it now, but we'll see. All right. I want to go eat some sushi or order some sushi so then I can eat some sushi. So I'm out of here. Those of you who didn't sing, go back to the beginning and sing. You're not allowed to be done with this podcast until you go sing. So do that. And then next week it'll be somebody else's birthday, presumably. I assume there have been people born on January 28th. If you know who was born on January 28th, tell us about it in the blog, magicaltalkinghat.com. Also, if you have more questions about Final Fantasy games, or more pertinently, questions about absolutely anything else, write into the hat, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And then Hat will spit them out at us and we'll talk about them. Not this time, because we had things to say and it's my birthday, so I declared it that way. And go to Netflix and see Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and go to Amazon and watch One Night in Miami. They are good thing. Shit, I had a really great name for this episode and I've already forgotten it. It was right near the beginning, something we said that was funny. All right, well, you know, I know you guys know what it's called. So that's what we decided on.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.